All right. Good afternoon. I was a bit muted. Good afternoon. Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming to the session. It's great to see so many of you here. It's really nice to see so many people coming to listen to Silverlight. Let me say hello properly. My name's Mike Talty. I work for Microsoft in the UK. And I have all of my contact details on the slide, so if you want to mail me, if you want to find my website, or if you want to tweet at me. Who's tweeting these days? Quite a lot of people. So if you want to tweet at me, then you can also tweet at me using that information. If you tweet at me during the session, I won't be reading it right now in the session. I'll have to catch up with it later on. And actually, you should be watching the session. Don't tweet at me during the session. Don't do that. So what we've got this afternoon is we're here to talk about Silverlight 4. And what I'm not planning to do is an overview of Silverlight. That isn't what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about is what's new in Silverlight 4, and we've split that out into two sessions. So how many folks were expecting to attend a two-part session today? Okay, great, that's cool. Because I wouldn't like you to attend half of this and then not attend the other half, so that's really the thing. This is part one, obviously. Silverlight is heading towards version 4. It's still relatively a young technology. We released version 1 back in 2007, version 2 in 08, version 3 in 09, and version 4 is on its way. We put out a release candidate of Silverlight 4 just 2 weeks ago at the Mix conference, and we've announced, I think just yesterday, that Silverlight 4 will launch at Dev Connections April 12th to the 14th. So we're only a few weeks away from Silverlight 4. It's worth remembering, of course, that Silverlight is a cross-browser and cross-platform solution. And so the one addition that we make there with Silverlight 4 is we now also add another browser. We add official support for Google's Chrome browser in Silverlight 4. Beyond that, there are many, many things that we could talk about as coming new in Silverlight 4. There's lots and lots of different things that we could talk about, all these things flashing up on the screen behind me. I can't guarantee to you that I will cover every single one of these topics. If you want to write them down and cross them out as we go, I can't guarantee to you we'll hit every single one of these things today, but we'll try and see a good spread of these features as we go along, the new things that are coming in Silverlight 4. In order to do that, what I've done is partition this session off into two. You are currently sitting in session one. Session two happens later in the day. And here in session one, I'm going to talk about tooling. I'm going to talk about data binding. I'm going to talk about validation. I'll talk about networking, and I'll talk about navigation. Just promoting session two for a moment. Let's just let that guy pop up. In session two, we'll come back. We'll talk about enhancements to controls. We'll talk about desktop integration features. That's quite a big section of that second session. A big chunk of that stuff will be about desktop integration features. And we'll also talk a little bit about frameworks, the new RIA services framework and the new managed extensibility framework, or MEF. But that's what we're doing later in the day. It's just an advert for session two. Here we are in session one. And what I want to talk about here is tooling, Visual Studio and Expression Blend. I want to talk about binding and validation, a little bit about networking, and a little bit around navigation. And I'll use this slide as we go through the session so that we know where we're up to. And currently where we're up to is talking about Visual Studio. So rather than talk about Visual Studio here, let's go and wander off into Visual Studio and have a look at a few things over here in Visual Studio. So I'm running Visual Studio 2010 RC, the release candidate, and if I wander in here, let's just go and experiment with Silverlight in Visual Studio 2010. I'm going to make a new Silverlight application, stick it in C temp, that's fine. And the first thing you'll notice when you wander into Visual Studio 2010 with Silverlight 4 is that Visual Studio supports multi-targeting for Silverlight applications. So you can build a Silverlight 3 application, you can build a Silverlight 4 application in Visual Studio 2010. I'm just going to pick a website. Let's create that thing. And we'll let Visual Studio spring up. The first thing it's going to do is display for me a designer, a graphical designer that I can actually graphically design upon. And this is the first time we've had this in Visual Studio for Silverlight. So let me just switch over to show the designer. And let me just split that thing so that we've got the designer and the XAML on the screen at the same time, which is kind of how I like to use it. So I just want to show you a few things around the designer, because we're doing some nice things in the designer in VS 2010. Let's first off just go over here and say I want to select this grid and how this works with the properties window. Let's go over to my properties window on my grid. What you can do in the properties window is quite a lot. If you take a look at it, it's categorized out. So we can have a look at categories of properties. We can do an A to Z on those properties. we can also go ahead and get this categorized by where properties are coming from. Are they coming from styles? Are they coming from binding? Are they coming from inheritance? I like mine categorized this way. I can also go ahead and search. So if I wanted to change the background on that grid, I can grab that background. Let's go and grab it. We can wander over here. We've got a proper editor in the designer for changing things like that background. So let's just change it very quickly. Let's make it kind of red at one end and kind of red at the other end as well. If I didn't, what this is actually doing is putting an inline background into my XAML file here, and I don't necessarily want that. So let me just go and take that linear gradient brush and chop it from there. We'll just take it out of there, away from that background. And I'm more likely to put that into a resource collection, so let me wander over to my app.xaml over here and drop it into my app.xaml's resources. And I'll just give this thing a little key, so we'll go ahead and say x key equals my brush, something like that. I can't type. Let's wander back over to here. What I can do, if a designer has given me that kind of asset, I can just go to my grid, grab its properties again, and I can do lookup on that background property and apply a resource to it. I can wander in. We've only got one. I can search in here. I can find that resource and just drag drop it, and I've got that resource. So I've got nice lookup on resources in that properties window. Let me also go and add a little bit of code in here. So let's go to our solution and add to this a new class. I have no idea what we just did. No. Let's go here and add a new class. And I'll call this class Person. And let's just write a little code in here. So we'll just collapse this down. I want my Person class to implement property change notification. That's very common in Silverlight. I have a snippet to do it. All these snippets here are my snippets. They're not Visual Studio standard snippets, just in case you're wondering. So I'm just going to throw in a class that implements property change notification. Let's just collapse that back down. Collapse that back down. And then what I want to do is take my Person class and just derive it from a property change notification. So let's just go ahead and do that. Just derive it from that. And I'll add a few properties onto this. So we'll add a, let's add a string, which is a first name. Let's add a string, which is a last name. And let's go ahead and add a date or something. Let's say a date time, date of birth, something like that. And I actually want to use this class in XAML, so I'm just going to attribute this. This is nothing to do with what I'm showing you really here. It's just something I have to do. Let me just go and add a reference. By the way, we fixed that dialog as we go through there. Let's just go to system.windows.controls. And I'm just going to add a quick reference so that I can use this from XAML. Let me just say I want a type converter on this thing. Just paste that on there. So that's really nothing to do with what I was showing you here. I just need to do that. Let me collapse down this Person class, and let's have a little collection of people. So I'll just say we'll have another class. We'll say Person Collection, and I'll make that observable collection of Person. So just trying to get to some data, really, that I can throw in. Okay, so I've got my little Person Collection. I should have said observable collection. I've been a bit careful with that. So let me go over to my app.xaml now and throw in one of those Person collections. So I want to work with that local namespace. Let's say local equals. Let's go ahead and bring in Silverlight application 1 as a namespace. And then we'll say we'll have a local Person collection. We'll call it people data, something like that. And I'll throw into there some local persons. We'll say first name, last name, approximate date of birth. It's the right year. I just don't want to share. These things are used for online banking these days. Let me go and throw somebody else in here. Fred can be born just slightly later. Okay, great. Let me just build, and let me get rid of the spurious observable collection class that I inserted whilst we were messing around there. Bye-bye. And let me go back to my mainpage.xaml. So imagine what I want to do now is take my user control here, and if I want to take the user control, it's useful to be able to select and go to the document outline because that will show me what it is I'm actually selecting. It'll actually highlight it for me. So I can go to the document outline. And perhaps what I want to do is change the data context on that thing. So let's just go to the data context. And we'll grab that, and I can go and select that resource again, my people data over there. And then let's go and mark out our grid a little bit. So again, let's just make sure we're selecting the grid. And we'll just mark it out with a grid row over here. And let me pop to the toolbox and drag and drop from the toolbox, the list box. So the list box pops up over there. Now, the design is nice. It has nice little snap lines and so on to show you where things are going. I generally don't lay things out that way. I normally want to reset all the margins and padding and sizes. And you can do that in the designer by just saying reset layout. I found that quite a useful thing to be able to do. Let's just put a little margin around it, though. So let's go to margin over here, and we'll set that to, say, 6. And then I want today to bind my list box. So let's just go to the item source of the list box, and let's go ahead and apply data binding to that. And we're already showing the data. Let me just go and change the font size so that you guys can see it a little bit. Set that to 18 or so on. Now, I might not want to display a two-string like I'm doing at the moment on those people. What I might want to do is have a data template. So I could edit a data template. So let's go to our resources, and we'll have a data template. Let's say key equals my template. And let's just have a stack panel. Maybe we'll make that stack panel horizontal, something like that. And let's just go and throw in a couple of text blocks here. You can see my typing is not quite right. Let's go and bind first name. Let's go and have another one that binds to last name. And let me just put a little string format on that thing. This is new, actually, in Silverlight 4. I'll talk about this later on. Just to bind that nicely. Too many quotes. Too many braces, too many quotes. Looks fine. Yeah. So let me pop back over to my XAML. And hopefully those things will start to display properly. If we go and set the template, so let's go back to the list box. Let's grab its properties again. I want to set its data template. Or to set its item template, actually. And let's go and just, again, apply a resource. It's going to be my template. And that starts to display itself nicely. But typing in XAML isn't so much fun. It can be. But what I don't want to do here is always type in XAML. So if I wanted to do, say, a little details view down at the bottom here, so if we want to just add a little details view, then what I could do is go to my data sources over here and add a new data source. Let's go and throw one of those things in. And on the data source, I'll select an object. I'll select the person class that we've been writing. Let's finish that. And that should whir away and generate a new data source for me over here. I can take that. It could be a grid. It could be the list box we just created manually. But I'm going to take details and drag it, drop it onto that side over there. And we should create all the XAML for you to display that stuff just kind of in a default way. Once again, if I make sure that I'm selecting the right thing, that grid there, let me just go and reset its... Ooh. Really? Let's just build. Okay. And let's just go and reset all the layout on that thing. And maybe I don't want that column over there either, so let me just drag him off there and select these three guys, and let's reset their layout as well. And maybe around that whole grid, I want perhaps the parent grid. Let's just go to its document outline here. Maybe I want that row to auto-size itself. And maybe I want the child grid. Let's just find that guy again. I'll put a little margin around that so we can go and grab margin. We'll set it to say something big. Let's set it to say 24, something like that, just to space that stuff out. I'd also want the data context to be correct on that thing. So let's go to data context. And this is something I really like, is I can wander in here and apply data binding. I can go and select that what I want to do is pick it up from my list box, find the path, find the selected value. Let's just go find that thing. And just bind that thing across naturally onto that selected value. Let's run it. I tell you what, let's run it out of browser. So let me go and make this application an out-of-browser application. Let's just go to properties. We'll specify that this is an out-of-browser application. Let's do that. Let's press F5. Switch on debugging. Let's let that spin up. Okay, let me install it out of browser. So we'll just right mouse and install that out of browser. One of the pain points around working with out of browser applications for me today is that what I tend to do is I install like this, and then I remove it, and then I change the code, and then I run it up again, and then I install it again. And it just makes my F5 debugging cycle take longer and longer and longer. I don't need to do that with Silverlight 4 in Visual Studio 2010. I can simply shut down the application. I can go to the startup settings for debug. Tell it I want an out-of-browser application. Tell it to make this the start project. Press F5, and the application should be straight back on the screen ready to be debugged, so we don't have to mess about. Just making sure that our binding is working as we do that stuff. So that's really nice. It just kind of speeds up that whole cycle around debugging with VS 2010. One last thing I just want to show you here in Visual Studio before we move on is if I was to go to this solution and add a new class library, let's just go and add a new project, and add a class library, Silverlight class library 1, let's OK that. And what I could do in here is throw in a little class just with a snippet. So there's my person class in the library. And it wouldn't surprise you, hopefully, at all to know that I can go to the Silverlight application up in here and I can add a reference to that project. So I can add a reference to a Silverlight class library from a Silverlight project. That makes perfect sense. I could also go over here, though, which might be surprising if you've not seen it before, and I can add a new project. That project might be a Windows console application, for instance. Throw that in there. And let's go ahead and just add a reference from that console application to that Silverlight class library project. And from there, let's go and start using that person class that we've got in the Silverlight class library project. Oops, we've named it incorrectly. So now we can start to work with that thing, and so on and so forth. Quite surprisingly, we're referencing a Silverlight library from a full .NET framework application. Now, you can do this within restrictions. You need to be a little bit careful about the libraries that your Silverlight class library references. But if you stay within a certain subset, then you can use those things from a full .NET framework application, sharing binary code across those two things. Okay, so some things there in Visual Studio. Let me shut this down. And where I want to go from there is to talk a little bit about Expression Blend. Now, I must admit, in preparing this talk, I wasn't sure whether to put Expression Blend in here for you or not. I couldn't decide whether you'd want to see the Expression Blend features. But I want to show you some of the code aspects of things that are going on in Expression Blend, because I think it's really interesting from the point of view of developers. So I just want to show you some of those things. What I'm running here is Expression Blend 4 beta. This came out just 2 weeks ago at the Mix conference, so this is fairly new. And if you wander into Expression Blend 4 beta, what we can do is do a new project. And you get a new project in here. Of course, you can make Silverlight 4 applications, but in here, you get the data-driven model view view model application template. Are people familiar with this model view view model, MVVM? Are you seeing a lot of this around? Okay, great. So I'm not going to explain that in any detail here. Model view view model is a pattern. Essentially, from the purposes of what we're going to show here, the idea is that you have a view, which is almost entirely declarative and just presents things. You have a view model, which provides the data and the functionality to that view. The view doesn't know about the view model. The view model doesn't know about the view. They just data bind together. This is great from the point of view of designability, testability, and maintainability. Let's just see what Blend is doing with this MVVM template then. Let's OK that and make a new one of these applications. OK, so what happens when I create one of these in Expression Blend? And apologies for the sizes of the people at the back. I know Blend can be difficult to see. What happens here is that we get a new application with a main page. The main page is displaying a main user control. I'm just going to change its width and height because it's hard-coded to the wrong value. Let's just set that to something else. And I'll just set a design width and height over here. And you'll notice that on this main page, we have the main view, which is just a user control. If we go back to the project, the main view is here in this folder. I'm going to close down this main page, and we'll not visit it again, I don't think, but we'll save the changes on it. Our main view over here is just a view. And what it has on it is a button and a text block. And if we scroll this up, you'll probably be able to see that this says sample text property value as we scroll it back down. Let me just size that. So there's a button on here and there's a text block, and that's what's on the main view. If we look into the XAML for this, let's just go into the XAML here, press F4, and we can see that the data context for the grid is set to this resource. And this resource is the main view model. So the view is data binding to the view model. You might also notice as we scroll across that we also use a design time data context, which is pointing at a XAML file, as a design time data context on there as well. Let's go and take a look at this view model. Where is this class? Let's just press F4 on this and pop back. It's over here in the view models folder. Here's the main view model. And the main view model just implements property change notification. Excuse me. And you'll notice that it has an example property, which is set to runtime property value, and it has an example method, which does something. I don't really care too much what it does, but it has an example method. Now, if you've looked at data binding in Silverlight, you'll know it's very easy to bind to a property, but you'd also know that you can't really bind to a method. But being able to bind to this method is something that really makes model view view model work in terms of keeping apart the view and the view model. So what expression blend does, if you take a look at this text block back on the designer over here, the text block, if we look at its properties, the text block has its text data bound. That makes perfect sense. The button, if we take a look at the button and its properties again, let me just keep that guy out for a second. The button over here, actually, I want to look at it in the objects and timeline view. So the button over here, he has a behavior, or more specifically, an action. He has one of expression blends, triggers, actions, behaviors associated with him, and that behavior, if we take a look at its properties, will go off and call the right method using reflection. This allows us to declaratively invoke a function from the view with just no data binding, but we have triggers, actions, behaviors to make this work for us. Expression blend 4 comes with more triggers, actions, and behaviors like call method and like invoke command. If you have an iCommand property, we can invoke it using this particular action. This becomes quite a useful thing, as I'll show you in a second. Just to finish off with this template, though, what we get also is sample data. And if we look at the XAML for the sample data, here is the view model. And if we scroll it across, there is where the sample property is coming from on the screen. So what I want to do is just delete that sample data. Let's get rid of that. And I want to create my own view model. So let's just go to view models over here. Let's find the code. And I want to get rid of all this code. And I'm just going to throw in some code of my own. So I'm going to pop over here, grab an extra file. Let's just send that to my clipboard and paste this in here. Quite a bit of code. Let's just take a look at it. What this is meant to be is a representation of a sort of shopping basket. That's the idea. And so what we've got is a view model. And the view model has a collection of available items, items to be purchased. These just have names and prices, so they're very simple. Then we've got a collection of items in your shopping cart. So that's just a collection. The total amount that you've spent so far. And then what I have is a command. So commands are already in Silverlight 3. iCommand is already there. And what this command does is it populates the available items collection with a bunch of hard-coded entries. And you'll notice that this command, in Silverlight, there is no implementation of iCommand, so I'm using action command from expression blend. That lives in the expression blend libraries. So that when you invoke this command, I will run this code here and populate the available items. We've also got a command that adds an item to the basket. So it takes a parameter, and it walks up to the basket, adds it to the shopping cart, removes it from the available items, increments the total spend. And we have another command, and it does exactly the reverse. Adds things to the available items, removes it from the cart, decrements the total spend. Let me just build that guy up. So what I want to do is put a little UI onto that. Let me go back to my view over here. And if we take a look at this thing, let me just bring out the environment for a second. If we take a look at this thing, what I wanted to do was design this in front of you. It took 45 minutes for me to do it, so I decided that was a bad idea. So instead of doing that, let me just take the XAML, and we'll just get rid of some XAML in here and paste in a view. So I'm just going to go ahead, pop to my extra files, take this guy, pop him in here. So I'm using some new controls in Expression Blend 4. I just need a reference for those. These are these drawings that we've got over here. So let me just add a quick reference. I know. I can't fix it yet. Let me add a quick reference. We'll go out to Microsoft SDKs, Expression Blend, Silverlight version 4, libraries, and the drawing assembly. And if that's in place, I should be able to open that back in the designer. So this is a little UI that I drew. And you might notice that we're using these shapes. These are new in Expression Blend 4. You've got a whole bunch of shapes you can just drag and drop onto the design surface. But if I'm a designer now, I've got my list boxes here ready to populate. I've got a view model from a developer, but what do I do with it? In Blend 4, you can do some interesting stuff. If you go to the Data tab, you can walk up to the Add Sample Data and create sample data from a class. So what I'm going to do is take my view model and create sample data from that. Let me just make sure we can build at that point. So what that does is it shows me as a designer the view model over here. And let's say I want to get the available items in that list box on the left-hand side. I can drag and drop and data bind onto that list box. And Expression Blend just generated test data for me based on a C-sharp, a .NET object definition. I could take the cart items and drag them to the list box on the right-hand side, and blend makes data for me again. As a designer, I'd probably want to retemplate those things, so let's just quickly change the template so that you can see them a little bit better. Let's go over here, find the item template, change the template so it's bigger. Let me do that there as well. And we get different templates on those things. But now what I want to do, that's test data that I see on the screen just for design time. If I run the application, there will be no data until I call that load command. So what I want to do is take the load command and drag and drop it onto one of these shapes, for instance. Let's just drop it there. And Blend will generate the right interactions in order to make that command be invoked when you touch that particular shape. If we take a look at it, just wander over here, and we'll find our shape. What it just did was make an invoke command action on that particular shape. So now when we run this stuff up, I can go straight from that view model to dragging and dropping and get functionality. So for instance, I should be able to go and load my items up on the left-hand side by just touching on that shape. I can make the rest of the UI work in a similar way. Let's go back. Let's take the add item to basket command. Let's drag it onto that shape. And that command has parameters associated with it, so let me just go and find the parameter. And we'll take the parameter here and let's element bind it to the list box over here. And what I want to bring out is the selected value. Let's go find the selected value of that thing. Similarly, I want to move my other command, which removes an item, onto this shape. And that also has a parameter, so let's go and find its parameter. Let's go and element bind that thing over here to this list box and its selected value. Whilst I'm here, it would be nice to bind up that total spend that we've got down at the bottom of the screen. Let's bind that. Let's press F5 and see how we're doing. So we should be able to load items. We should be able to move items across, move them back. Notice how I'm just dragging and dropping on top of a view model that a developer has provided for me, and hopefully start to see how powerful this stuff can become. At that point, really, the developer aspects of this are done. Do you want to see just a little bit of some UI aspects in Blend 4? Anybody? Takers? Okay, so let me show you a few cool things in Blend 4 that I just think are really interesting. So one thing we can do in Blend 4 that's new is the idea of animating layout. You can have fluid layout. So let me go to this control over here. Let's just slide up a little bit. And go to my user control, and let me define a couple of new states on this control. So we'll just define states. There's one, there's another. And the first state, maybe I can call it layout one. And the second state, maybe I can call it layout two. So I've got those two states on there. And what I'm going to do in layout two, I'm going to take one of these stack panels, the one at the top, let's just grab its properties, and find its layout properties. And I'm going to move it down into row four at the bottom. I'm going to take these two grids, and similarly, let's just find their layout properties, not brushes. Layout properties. I'm going to move them into grid row 0 at the top. So we change the layout. And what Blend can do for us in version 4 preview is that we can go and animate the changes between those two layouts. We switch on fluid layout up here. Let's just give it a little time to do the animation. Let's say that we want to see the previews. Let's apply a little easing function to make it smooth. And you can see how we're animating between those two layouts. You can do all kinds of fancy animation effects between layouts. I guess we might want that to happen when somebody uses the UI. So what we could perhaps do, actually while we're here, you can also do transition effects between transition states in Blend 4. So I could go and switch on an effect here. So let's go and switch on, say, what would be really gratuitous, a ripple effect. Let's have a ripple effect on there. And then as we move between those two things, not only do we animate, but we ripple as well. I'd want that to be tied to the UI, so let me go back to my assets. Let me grab a behavior. Let me grab a goToState action and drag him to that shape over there. Let's get its properties, and we'll say what you do is drive layout state 1. And let's go back over here and grab a goToState action, drag it over there, and let's say that what you do is drive layout state 2. We can press F5, and then we're wiring those things up again declaratively without writing code in order to do that stuff. So we should be able to transition between those two layouts quite nicely just using the UI. get the idea of that. We can also do some fancy stuff around items in list boxes. Items with Silverlight 4 and Blend 4 can be animated in and out of list boxes. So let's just take a quick look at that. Let's go to one of my list boxes over here, and let's find its item container style and just edit that. So just edit that item container style. And actually, what I want to do is just walk up to that thing, and if we look at it, you'll see it also has some new states. So you have the notion of list box items before, after they are loaded, and before they are unloaded. And so we can animate these items in and out as they come in and out. So we could say, look, before loaded, let's just go ahead and apply a little effect to this stuff. Let's say we'll have a slide, something like that. So we'll apply a slide over 1 second. And we should just be able to apply that. Let's just make sure we got that on below loaded, after loaded. And so what we should find now as we run that back up is our list box items animate their way in and out of these list boxes. So let's just make sure that they do. So as we create items and animate it over there, you'll see it slides, and it slides back in over there. We can apply arbitrary effects on these items. They can swing in from 3D, whatever it is you want to do. You can do all of that stuff. Let me also show you something about layout in list boxes. Just navigating back over here, let me add a quick reference to the Silverlight toolkit. So I'm just going to go out, add a reference, expression, no, excuse me, SDKs, Silverlight version 4 toolkit. Let me just pick up an assembly from the toolkit. Because what I want to do is go to my list box over here on the right, on the left-hand side. Let me just grab that guy. And I'm just going to change its items panel. So let's go to its items panel and grab the stack panel that's currently there, and I'll change it into a wrap panel from the toolkit. The reason I'm doing that is to show you fluid layout inside of a list box. So what I can now do with that wrap panel is go to my assets, find a behavior. We have this behavior called fluid movement. I drag it onto that wrap panel, set its properties to tell it that it applies to the children, add little easing functions to it. Just set one property so it picks up the right thing. Press F5. And now what we're doing on that list box is animating items' positions within the list box as they lay themselves out. So if we go and just bring in the items over here, you'll see as we start to size the list box differently, that those items just magically flow around and do that. You can apply any transition effect you want in this stuff. It's just magically doing that. Now, the list box on the right-hand side isn't doing this right now. Let's walk to the list box on the right-hand side. This guy. No, excuse me. This guy. And let's go up to the items container style and apply the same style. And let's go up to the items panel and apply the same style. And let's press F5. And you get an unexpected magic bonus here, which the first time I saw it, I was surprised by. So not only do items now on the left-hand side lay themselves out nicely, of course, and they'll do the same thing on the right-hand side, but they also animate themselves from right to left, just for free. I guess it was one of the things just because we could. Over on the right-hand side, of course, they'll do the right thing as well and lay themselves out magically as well. All right, so I guess one last thing. We've said a couple of things there about list boxes. I just want to show you one more thing with list boxes. There's a new kind of list box in Expression Blend 4. Let me go all the way out to my main page here, and let's get rid of the UI. So let's go here. I can't show you this really with this particular list box. It won't look right. So let me get rid of the UI, and let me go to my assets and bring in the path list box. So we've got this new list box called the path list box. Let's take one of those and drag it on here like so. And let's just give it some data to play with. So I'll go to the test data, and we'll just make sample data in here. And if you played with Expression Blend, you'll know it comes with some sample images, which are pictures of chairs. I don't know why they're pictures of chairs. But let's just set the sample data to be a string, which is a name over here. Let's set this sample data to be an image, which will be a picture of a chair. And then we'll drag that collection onto the list box. And you can see that the pictures of the chairs start to appear. What the path list box can do, though, is it can display those items along any number of arbitrary paths. So we can take a graphics path from here. Let's grab a pen or something. And let's just make a path. So we're kind of, woo. I am a designer at heart, and you know that. Let's just go grab this thing, and let's change its fill so that it doesn't fill, because it's got a fill on it at the moment. Let's just go and say, we don't want you to fill. And then we can walk back up to that list box and we can specify its property as to using that particular path. And the items just go lay themselves out along that path. We can have multiple paths. We can start to play around with this stuff. We could say what we want to do is maybe apply a sort of normal transform at the, I don't know whether that's a tangent or a normal, I'm not going to worry about it right now. We can work out how that stuff works. We can decide how far along the path you want the items to go. You can animate this property. And you can start to have all kinds of fun. So if you couple that with the other stuff I showed you, hopefully you get to see there's an awful lot of stuff in Blend. I think the main developer thing I wanted to talk about there was the MVVM aspects and how that is making things very drag and drop, very, very bindable. And I think that's very powerful stuff. So hopefully that came across as part of showing that there. Let me wander out of Expression Blend. Okay. So where I want to head next is very much back into data and developer territory. So it's certainly my opinion that in Silverlight, one of the absolute key aspects of the framework is data binding. If you're not data binding in Silverlight, then I have to question what it is you're actually doing. And so data binding, I think, is vital, and there are some changes to data binding in Silverlight 4. They're fairly small things, but let's just take a look at some of those and see how those work out. Let me wander back. It's probably easiest if I run this application for you first, so let's just go back over here. Okay, so let's just let this thing and skip the breakpoints for the moment. Okay, great. So what you see on the screen is just a list box. It's very, very simple, deliberately simple. There are two items data bound into the list box. One is me, one is Jim. And if we take a look at this, you might notice that I have a first name, a last name, an age, and then I have a satisfaction score, which is not applicable, and I have a registration date, which is not applicable. If we take a look at Jim, come on, Jim. If we take a look at Jim, Jim has a first name, last name, age. He also has a satisfaction score, and a registration date is set on Jim as well. Just one other thing that we've got on the screen. At the bottom of the screen is a gratuitous slider. And no UI, of course, would be fit without one of these that does this. It is there for a reason. I'll talk about why it's there in a moment. It's just an illustration of something. We'll come back to that in a minute. So a few things about the data binding here. Let me show you how this stuff is set up. So what we've got here is a class person. And, of course, person has a first name, it has a last name, and it has an age. That's all there. And then I've also got another class, customer. So if we take a look at customer, customer is just derived from person. And customer adds two extra things. It adds a satisfaction score, and it also adds a little string indexer down here. So customer is one of those objects that I sometimes call expando objects. Does that resonate, expando objects? No? An object where you can just add any magic properties at runtime of any type you want. Something that has a property bag associated with it. So inside this customer class, we just make a little property bag of dictionary string to object, and then whenever you come through this indexer, we just let you set any property you want on this object to be of any type you want. So it's kind of an expandable object in that sense. So we have person, we have customer. I wrote a little person collection, of course, over here. It's just a collection of person. But when you create one of these, just to help my demo, I add an instance of person into that, and I add an instance of customer into that as well. I notice that the customer has a satisfaction score, and the customer has one of these magic properties, a registration date, set to the 1st of the 1st, 2000. So in the way that this stuff all ends up on the screen, if we go and take a look at our XAML file over here, you'll see that what we're doing is we've got a grid whose data context is one of those person collections. That's where our data comes from. And then we display a list box whose item source is that list of people. And then in that list box, on a per item basis, we display a bunch of stuff. I'm not really going to worry about all of the stuff, just want to show you a couple of aspects of it. So here we have a text box who is data bound, and you can see it's bound to the first name. And there's a couple of new things on this binding that don't exist in Silverlight 3. Some of them are simple and some of them are more complex. The first one here is very simple. We have this property called target null value. And what that means is that if the underlying value is null, then display in this case the value onSet. And vice versa. So, you know, so if I go back to the UI and I type in onSet, then what will go through to the underlying property is the value null. So we have a nice way of representing nulls in the UI. Very simple. It's worth saying, by the way, let me put that back. It's worth saying, by the way, that if we go back to our XAML, this target null value doesn't have to be a string. It can be any complex type that you like. The other thing we've got, if we scroll down a little bit, is that we've got our binding to the satisfaction score. And if you remember, we've got two objects on the screen. We have a person that doesn't have a satisfaction score, and we have a customer that does. And so what we do here is we use a fallback value. And the fallback value says, if you can't make the binding, then use this value instead. And I'm kind of using that here to represent my little object hierarchy on the screen, because person doesn't have a satisfaction score, whereas customer does have a satisfaction score. So we've got a nice way of dealing with what happens if you can't actually make a binding, something you might want to use. The other thing we do just below here is we have another text block which is bound to the string index of registration date. So we can bind to string indexes in Silverlight 4. It's a new thing that we can do. Again, I'm providing a fallback value on that thing. So again, over here, Jim has a registration date. If we scroll that up a little bit, I don't have a registration date, as you can see. I'm just using a fallback value for that binding. And I'm also using a string format on it as well. So we have string format specifiers, just like you do string.format in .NET, so you can now use the same things inside of a binding in Silverlight 4. And that's why our binding down here shows up as first of the first 2000 in short date format. So the last thing on here I want to talk about with binding is the gratuitous slider. If we take a look at how that's done, it's just up here somewhere. What I'm doing is just data binding the plane projection on the list box, and I'm binding its rotation. Now, this was perfectly possible in Silverlight 3. The plane projection is there in Silverlight 3, but what you couldn't do in Silverlight 3 is bind it in this way. Basically, if you look at this, what we've got is the plane projection is actually the target of the data binding. Now, in Silverlight 3, the target of a data binding needed to be a framework element. You needed to derive from framework element. In Silverlight 4, you don't need to derive from framework element, you derive from dependency object. And you might be thinking, well, that all sounds a bit esoteric. What that actually means in the real world is lots of things that didn't used to be so naturally bindable are now naturally bindable with Silverlight 4, like this thing that you see on the screen. If you walked up to one of these in Silverlight 3 and tried to make the binding, you can end up quite confused as to why you couldn't do it. You'll be able to do it and various other things with binding in Silverlight 4. So you just get more natural binding. Okay, so I want to switch really there and flick from binding to validation. You might have noticed that if we type in invalid values here on the screen, we're getting some validation errors out of this, and we can get different validations up there as well. Let's just let those run through. We get different validation errors out of this thing up here. So if we go back to our bindings and take a look at them for a second, let's go back over here to the bindings. And you'll see that, say, on the text box here where we have first name, let me just stop debugging for a moment. We've got this property here, notify on validation error. This is already there in Silverlight 3. What this means is tell my parent I have a problem. What we do with that setting, when you have a problem, we go up the tree, we find the parent, and we tell him or her about the problem. And then in this particular example, within that same parent, I have a validation summary which will pick up all of those problems and display them. So I get automatic display of my binding validation errors, which is just there in Silverlight 3. What's not there in Silverlight 3 is this new setting here. Let's go to the first one. Validates on notify data errors. And some of the naming for this stuff is quite wordy. But this setting isn't here in Silverlight 3. In Silverlight 4, we've actually got three different ways of doing this sort of automatic validation. If we take a look at them. The first one you've got is a setting called validates on exceptions. This was already there in Silverlight 3. What this means is if your underlying setters on your properties throw exceptions, we will display validation errors at that point. But this can be challenging. It's very difficult to do cross-field validation if you have to throw exceptions all the time. It's also very difficult to have multiple errors on a single property if you have to throw exceptions in the setters to represent errors. So this mechanism is fine, but it's a bit limited. In Silverlight 4, we've added two new mechanisms. One is one that already comes from the existing .NET framework, and it's called iDataErrorInfo. Anyone seen that interface before, iDataErrorInfo? There's a few folks seen that interface. So if you want to use that interface, then what you do is you say validate on data errors. True. But I have to say that I'm not a huge fan of that interface for doing this work. And the Silverlight people added another interface into Silverlight 4, which I think is a better way of doing things. And the naming of that is iNotifyDataErrorInfo. Catchy. So to switch that thing on, you use this guy here, validates on notified data errors. Let's go and take a look at what that interface looks like. So on my person over here, what we have is implementation of a base class that I've written. Let's just go and take a look at that base class. And that base class implements iNotifyDataErrorInfo. Let's take a look at the interface. So what does this interface actually require you to do? Well, number one, it says, have you got any errors? So that's pretty simple. Tell me if you've got any errors right now. Number two, what it asks you to do is tell me when your errors change. Now, this is really powerful for Silverlight because in Silverlight, a lot of things need to happen asynchronously with respect to the UI. You might go across to a server in order to validate something, and then you come back and you want to raise errors. So being able to raise errors like this is really useful. And then the last thing on this particular interface is give me your errors for a particular property. And I notice a few things here. Number one, you can have more than one error per property. Number two, there's no mention of exceptions. You can represent your errors with any custom object you want. You can do whatever you like. And then probably what's not particularly obvious here is we can also call you with the empty string, which means tell me about the whole object. Tell me whether the whole object is happy or not. Okay, so back on my, let's close off the interface. Let's close off the base class. I just had my little base class there, and any time you change one of the properties on my class, I just call validate down here, which is my own code. And if we take a quick look at validate, what it does is it resets all errors on the entity itself, the person. Then we do a little bit of pretend cross-field validation. So if we look at that, what that says is that if you're me, and you're lying about your age, then that's an error. And we'll go back over here. And so what we do if you're doing that is we add a new error to the whole object. So we add an error to the whole object. It's a cross-field error. Now, this error info here, this is my class. This is my way of representing an error. This is nothing to do with the .NET framework. And you'll notice that I don't think it would be right for any error ever to be represented without a misleading hex number on the front of it. So I chose to use a misleading hex number on the front of my error just to confuse any user that might actually see the error. As we scroll down, we validate the first name field. We make sure that you've provided it, and if you haven't, we add a property level error. We do the same for the last name. We do the same for the age, validating the range and adding an error. And so all that comes back to explaining that tiny little flag there. And if we run this code, we'll see that we do get those validations as we're running along. Let's just go and see that. Let's run this back up. Just let it go through our property setter. Let me clear that breakpoint. Mm-hmm. So as we move, if we leave fields unset, you can see we get an error up here. And that one will do the same thing. That's an error on that field. We also get an error on that field when we set it too low. If we set this to be a reasonable age, and we set that to be this guy, and we set it to be this guy, then everything's fine. If we set it to be me, then we get our cross-field validation error. And notice at that point, all the fields on the object are happy, but the object is not happy. And so we still see errors from that thing. So just a new way of doing validation there in Silverlight 4. I think it's quite a strong interface. That's really why I wanted to show you that. Okay, let's catch up with ourselves a little bit on the slides. We talked about Visual Studio 2010. We talked about Expression Blend 4. We talked about binding and validation. I want to switch and talk a little bit about networking in Silverlight 4. We've done some enhancements to the network stack in Silverlight 4. So let me just talk about a few things here. I'm going to talk about these as much as show them. I'll say why in a moment, but I'll show you some of these things, but I won't show you everything here. So in terms of the networking stack for Silverlight 4, in Silverlight there are two networking stacks. There's the browser stack and the client stack. There's two different stacks. And generally speaking, the client stack is the more capable stack. The client stack, for instance, supports all HTTP verbs. The client stack can get you all status codes back from the HTTP response. The client stack can get you the response headers and the response bodies. Generally speaking, it's the more capable stack. However, it does have limitations in Silverlight 3, and we've addressed some of those in Silverlight 4. So specifically, the client stack will now do integrated authentication. So if you're connecting across over Basic, Digest, or NTLM, the client stack can now do that two ways. It can do it sort of automatically by prompting the user for credentials, or it can take credentials from your code and do it that way. So there's two different ways the client stack can do that. The client stack also gets some new features. It supports caching. It supports progress on uploads. It supports setting the referrer header. And I think we've also increased the number of concurrent connections on that stack from 2 to 6. So we've done some stuff around the client HTTP stack in Silverlight 4. We've also done some stuff at the socket level. Has anyone written socket code with Silverlight 3? Gentleman over there initially said yes and then panicked. Don't worry, you don't have to come up and write any, it's okay. So if you've looked at sockets in Silverlight 3, we can do TCP connected sockets in Silverlight 3. One of the pain points around it is that you first have to be authorized by a security policy. And to get that security policy, you have to do a rather strange handshake over port 943 across the network over TCP to get this security policy. It's a bit painful. Silverlight 4, you can also optionally request that security policy over HTTP in exactly the same way as you do for the security policy for the HTTP stacks. So that makes it a lot easier. Also at the socket level, we've added support for UDP multicasting. So if you're interested in multicasting scenarios, that's there as a sockets layer in Silverlight 4. WCF gets enhanced in Silverlight 4 with a new TCP channel. So if you were considering socket programming, maybe switch to use WCF TCP because that programming model is far easier than writing raw socket code. That's there in Silverlight 4. And then finally, WCF data services, or that's a technology that was formerly known as ADO.NET data services, which is a technology that was formerly known as Astoria. This technology has had a lot of names. WCF data services in Silverlight 4, the stack that speaks the OData, the Open Data Protocol, that you can find up at odata.org. It's just a RESTful protocol for getting data. In Silverlight 4, that supports arbitrary projections of data so that you can not return the whole data set back from the server. You can just return the columns you want. It supports automatic change tracking on the client so that you don't have to write code that says if this entity is dirty and if this particular field is dirty, you don't have to write that kind of code. And it also supports cross-domain access, which is pretty key, so it allows you to go cross-domain. So I won't show you all of these things here. Let me just try and show you a little bit of it with a mixture of the integrated authentication stuff and the WCF data services. Let me just try and show you a couple of those bits. Let's pop back over here. Okay, so we're in a different project. Let me just get the... okay, there we go. And all I've done here is I've started off building a data service on the server side, and I started building that with the entity framework. So I just have three tables in my entity framework: model, product, supplier, and category from the Northwind database. So it's very simple stuff. I took that model and turned it into a data service, which really just means I did add new item. And when I did an add new item, I typed in Northwind entities into that particular piece of code, and that's all you need to generate a data service. This gives me a data service on the server side. I can view it in the browser. Let's take a look at it. Okay, so interesting. I can't view it in the browser because it requires HTTPS. So let's just go and plug in HTTPS on that thing. And actually, I also need to put my full host name in here because otherwise the certificate doesn't match. So bear with me while I type in my full and lengthy host name. And then you'll notice that it wants authentication. It's like jumping through hoops to get to this service. So it does basic authentication. And if I log in here, then finally the browser will be able to display the service. Let me just ramp that up a little bit for you at the back. So the browser can display the service. It's just a standard WCF data service speaking the OData protocol. And so I can, if you've not seen this stuff before, I can just use URI navigation to reach into this and grab suppliers, for instance. And we wander in and get that whole data set of suppliers. And we can wander into supplier number one by primary key and find that data. And in supplier one, we could navigate to the products for that particular supplier. And when we navigate to those products, we could navigate to product number one. It's probably primary key. And you've got to stop sometimes, so let's go and pull out the product name or something like that. Wandering. So we can get data from this data service. We navigate by URI. This is the OData protocol. It doesn't just do query. It also does insert, update, delete as well. But we've got a data service. You noticed it was protecting itself with basic authentication, and it was accessed over HTTPS. So what I've got back in my project, if we close this stuff down, is that is on one website running on IIS. I have a Silverlight application. The Silverlight application is served by another website running on Cassini, my integrated web server. So we've got Silverlight application on a website, which is then calling across to another website to get data service data. In order to make use of that data service, all I have to do, of course, is add a service reference. So I've already done that. I added a service reference, discovered the project, click on data services. Now, you would need to hit this over HTTPS, but if you do that and authenticate, Visual Studio will go through and read the service description and build you a proxy. I've already done that, but it will do that stuff for you, even though you require authentication. And so we've got that stuff into this proxy code here. Let me just go and insert a couple of rows of data to play with. Bear with me while I just insert some data into my Northwind database. And I think double-clicking on a SQL file doesn't load the SQL file, so let's just do that. So I'm just going to put two rows into my database so that I can play with those rows. Let's just go use Northwind. Oh, no. I don't want to break one. Let's use Northwind. Let me get rid of any old data. Let me put in some new data. Okay, bye-bye. Right, so we've got some data to play with. Let me spin up the application. So this is just very, very simple form that I've got coming onto the screen. Anytime soon. And you can see this is coming from 32768. That's served up by Cassini. And then what this allows me to do is select categories and suppliers and then go and get some data. Let me just zoom that down from 150%. It's perhaps a bit better like that. So maybe perhaps in the first instance, let me just show you what this does. I can go and load my static data for these two combo boxes at the top that gives me drop-downs of categories and suppliers. I'm getting them from my data service. So I'm getting them from HTTPS productservice.svc. So clearly, we are going cross-domain with this. We're going from here, and we're going to there. Let's go and see if we can load our static data. And we end up in a breakpoint. So what we're doing here is we create the proxy that was generated by Visual Studio. If you've specified a username and password, I set it up. Otherwise, we load up our category data. Let's load that category data. And the proxy comes with strongly typed properties on it, like categories here. And we can just use those to execute queries. Now, Silverlight, of course, needs to do that asynchronously. And so here we do a begin execute. I just want to make the point in your mind that this categories property here is not a populated lump of data on the client. It is an implementation of iQueryable that knows how to dynamically build a URI. And you might be able to see the URI showing up there if I could get to the whole thing, but there's the URI building up. So all we do is we go and load the categories asynchronously. And because we're behind basic authentication, the client stack in Silverlight will prompt for that authentication. So we just logged in on the client stack. Then we load up the suppliers in the same way. And we should see categories, and we should see suppliers. I can switch on my is filtering property over there. So we just went through authentication on the client stack. What I could then do is go and load my product data. So I've got some product data. Let's click Get Data. And what we do here is we start querying the products collection. Again, this is just building up a URI on the client. So we say query equals all products. And let me just show you what's being built up here. It's probably quite useful to show. So So there's the query as it stands at the moment. We're writing it in link, but we're turning it into a URI. If filtering is switched on, then what we do is we add in filtering for the category and the supplier. And so we trundle down a little bit, and you'll notice that our query, if we reevaluate it and have a look at it, now has filtering for the category and the supplier. And then that other feature that we talked about on the slide, I don't actually want to bring back all of the data. So I say that I want to select just these five separate columns. And that means that only that data will flow across the network from the server back to the client. So that just cuts down the amount of bandwidth that I'm using for my transmission across the network. What I finally do is execute that query asynchronously. And when it comes back, we use a new class in Silverlight 4, the data service collection of T, which is great because it's an observable collection, and it also can do automatic change tracking for us. So we're doing automatic change tracking down on the client, which means that once that data returns, and I want to change some values here, change that to 55, change that to 23, whatever it might be, I don't have to write any code to do that because we're just using automatic data binding with the automatic tracking stuff to make that happen. Equally, if I want to delete a row, all I have to do is go ahead and remove it from the collection. That's all I've got to do. Nothing goes across the network at that point with data services. We have to make another explicit call to say that we want to save changes asynchronously and just let that stuff go across the network. So quite a few things in that. Let's just let that run across. The other thing I just wanted to show you was that we could also log in on the client stack by providing our own credentials. So let me shut down the application. Let me spin it back up. And on the client stack again, we should be able to wander up to this thing, specify a username and password, and go and load that static data. You'll see that we should be setting up that we no longer want to use the default credentials on the proxy, and we've got specific credentials to use. So as we run along, we should be able to load up that data without asking the user for any credentials, and we've got that data back from the server. So quite a useful thing to be able to do, integrated authentication on that client stack, especially if you're combining it with things like data services. So as I say, I didn't show you absolutely everything here in terms of networking. If you want to know more about networking in Silverlight 4, I'm doing a session tomorrow at 10 to 11, I believe, and that is a sort of guided tour of the Silverlight 4 networking stack. So we won't just do the what's new, we'll do the what is, that kind of thing, and try and run through the capabilities. And I'll show you some more of those things in that session tomorrow if you come along to that session. One more last thing I just wanted to touch on here before we break and then come back later in the day was around navigation. So I just wanted to touch on a new feature of Silverlight navigation. Navigation is already there in Silverlight 3. And so in Silverlight 3, if you have a URI like the one we've got on the screen, which uses a hash that is a URI fragment, and we navigate the browser to that long URI that you see on the screen, if you're using Silverlight 3 or 4, and you have a frame control from Silverlight on that page, inside of that UI, I should say, then we will pass across that fragment to you as a navigation URI, and Silverlight within the application can navigate backwards and forwards to content. The way it does it is by using a frame control, and a frame control takes those URIs and navigates to specific sets of pages. So you can see in the example on the screen, what we do is we say, I want to navigate to authors.xaml, and I've got a query string of name equals Steinbeck. And what that does is it causes the frame control to go out and load a control represented by authors.xaml. It loads that up. Generally speaking, that control needs to be derived from a class called page in the framework. Page has special navigation support on it, including an event called something like onNavigatedTo. So we take the full URI, we take the fragment on it, we give the fragment to the frame goes and finds the page, and then the page can say, why have I been navigated to, and load up things like the query string. That's how navigation works in Silverlight 3. In Silverlight 4, we make this more pluggable than it was in Silverlight 3. So in Silverlight 4, we can take a URI like the one we've got on the screen again. The top URI would be from outside the application. The bottom URI would be from inside the application, inside of Silverlight. And in Silverlight 4, what we can do, pass that to a frame. It can still run through a mapping stage, just like it did in Silverlight 3, so you still have mapping on there. The possibility of turning ugly internal URLs into pretty external URLs, so you can do SEO and so on. But there's also the possibility of plugging in a thing called a content loader. So in Silverlight 4, we can add this additional plugin point. And the responsibility of the plugin point is we've got a URI, and what we need is some control to display in the frame. The job of the content loader is to do whatever needs to be done to turn the URI into a control. And what it means is you've got a completely pluggable navigation framework in Silverlight 4. Let me try and illustrate that relatively quickly. Let's just pop back up here. So let me show an example first of simple navigation in Silverlight 4. So this is just the regular stuff that's already there in Silverlight 3, just in case you're not too familiar with navigation in the first place. So in this particular application, I've got a frame, and the frame initially navigates to slash categories. But you'll notice that I've got a mapper, and the mapper says that slash anything should be translated into slash pages slash anything.xaml. So this will be translated into pages categories.xaml. And over here in my project, I have pages categories.xaml. It represents a real control that actually exists. Let me just show you what happens when we run this thing up. This is just traditional Silverlight 3 navigations, nothing new here. So we run this stuff up, and it displays a whole bunch of images in a list box. And we can go to any one of these categories and view the image in that particular category. And you'll notice that when we do that, we are doing a navigation. And the navigation event is there. You can see the URI that we're navigating to, images where the category is architecture. And so what this particular images page does is it figures out the category and displays the right data with data binding, and that thing just pops up on the screen. So very, very simple. We can go backwards. We can go forwards. Navigation. We can go backwards. We can go forwards. Navigation. I got a bit stuck then, sorry. We can go backwards and we can go forwards. You get the idea. So I can just navigate into this with the URI. So I could go, I think we've got some for landscapes, something like that. Navigation. Through we go. But in Silverlight 3, this was tied to actually having sort of physical controls that represented the end point of the navigation. So there actually is a control over here, for categories.xaml and images.xaml. In Silverlight 4, we can unwire that if we want to. So let me show you a different example. Let me shut this guy down, start up a different example. Let me just let VS spin back up. So what I was doing was I was playing with that data services demo, and it occurred to me, and I have to say this is possibly a bit of a weird use of this navigation feature. I just want to show you how flexible it can be. But it kind of occurred to me that I could take one of those data services, like this one I've got here, which is the whole of the Northwind database. I made a data service out of that. And when I was preparing the other demo, I was playing with that data service. So let's just go to the data service, view in browser. And we'll just pop that up. And let me just size it a little bit bigger for you. So I was playing with this, and I was going to say customers or something like that. And we go and get the customers. And then I go to a particular customer, and we were doing that kind of stuff. And I was kind of thinking, I can pop back, and I can pop forward. And the browser is able to navigate between this content, even though it doesn't know what the content is. And I was thinking, well, can I do a similar thing with Silverlight? So I sparked up a different example in Silverlight. Let's just take a look at this. And what I've got here is a frame. Here's a frame in Silverlight 4 that has plugged in a custom content loader. So this content loader is written by me. It's over here. And it just implements iNavigation content loader. And we've plugged in a custom one of those into the frame. That means that when Silverlight wants to find content, it will speak to me rather than just trying to do it itself. And so let me show you also, I guess this frame also has its source data bound to a text box at the top of the screen. So if we run this stuff up, let's just let that spin up. So we navigate to the Silverlight page, and here's the text box, and the frame has its source bound to that particular text box. If I type in /customers and hit tab, that causes a navigation, and you can see we are navigating to /customers, and all I do is I take that URI and I add it onto the URI for my data service. So I'm saying as Silverlight navigates to /customers, hop across the network and grab that data from the data service, bring it back asynchronously, which is what we're doing here, and when that completes, grab the response. And I do a bit of a sneaky bit of work here to go from an XML atom response stream into a bunch of objects that can be data bound into a grid. I'm not going to dwell on that here. The point really is that I can do anything I want in between the start of a navigation, actually gathering the control, and in this case, returning dynamic UI back to represent the results of that. So if that all sounds a bit strange, what we end up doing here is navigating to /customers on that service. I can navigate to customers alpha key, something like that. Let's just kill the breakpoints for a moment so you don't have to sit and watch breakpoints. So now we navigate to that customer. I can navigate to his orders, killing that breakpoint. I can navigate to the employee that took those orders. Or maybe I can't. Oh, I can. It's probably got a big bitmap in it. Maybe not. Okay, I can't do what I just said I could do. But I could navigate to the shipper, perhaps, that shipped that order. Yes, I could. Fantastic. And I can go back. And I can go forward, and I can go back, and I can go forward. So that's possibly a slightly weird example, but really what I'm just trying to show you is that the navigation framework is now completely pluggable. You can do whatever you want. If you have dynamic plugins to load that represent the endpoints for navigation, you can load them up and do whatever you like. You can do anything you like with that framework. Okay, so at that point, I'll draw a line under session one. This is part one of what we had to cover. The thing I would say is that really we've only just gone sort of about halfway there. There's a whole ton of stuff that I want to cover in the second session. So I would encourage you to come back. I think we're back in this room at 4:30. Primary focus of that will be around desktop integration. So we'll look at things like printing. We'll look at things like webcam. We'll look at things like right mouse. We'll look at those desktop integration features and talk about trusted applications and features that opens up things like comm interop and so on. So that'll be in session two. I think we're back at 4:30. And in the meantime, all I would say is thanks a lot for coming to this session. I believe at the end of the day today, you will get a mail asking for feedback on sessions. And all I'll do as a personal plea in my sessions is encourage you to fill in that feedback. So whether it is good feedback, you liked the session, or whether it was bad feedback, I hated that session. Either way, for me, feedback is better than no feedback. So I just encourage you as a personal plea to fill in that thing. And hopefully, I would also encourage you to come back for part two. See you later in the day. Enjoy the next session. There's a gentleman called Heilsberg coming in. I don't know who he is. Thank you for coming. Thank you.